Almost daily in popular media, the Muslim world is pinpointed as a homogeneous entity that stands separate and parallel to the similarly imagined West. But even scratching the surface of the idea of a Muslim world reveals the geographic, social, linguistic, and religious diversity of Muslims throughout the world. So what work is performed through the employment and use of this phrase? And in what context did the idea of a Muslim world emerge? Jamil Aydin tackles these questions in his wonderful new book, The Idea of the Muslim World, A Global Intellectual History, published with Harvard University Press in 2017. In it, he weaves distant and interconnecting social, intellectual, and political histories of modern Muslim societies with clarity and detail. Altogether, he reveals the complex story of how the concept is constructed as a device intended to point to a geopolitical, religious, and civilizational unity among Muslims. The term is defined and employed by Muslim and non-Muslim actors alike across imperial and national contexts over the past nearly 150 years. In our conversation, we discuss the justifications for imperial conflicts, the effects of Christian nationalistic liberation and the colonization of Muslims, Orientalism, social Darwinism, the racialization of Muslims, the global role of the Ottomans, European and Russian imperialism, Muslim modernist thinkers, the effects of the world wars, and the changing political landscape of the late 20th century. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Without any further delay, here's my conversation with Jamil Aydin about The Idea of the Muslim World, A Global Intellectual History. Welcome, Jamil. Thank you for joining us here on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
Thank you. It's a great honor. And how are you?
I'm great. And it was really a great pleasure reading your new book, The Idea of the Muslim World. I must say at the start here that this is one of the most comprehensive works that I've seen that also very clearly articulates these kind of key arguments you're making and connects all the dots for the reader. And it certainly will be one of my go-to books in terms of helping people think about Islam in the contemporary moment we live in. So thank you for writing a very accessible and interesting book.
Thank you.
So it's our tradition here at New Books in Islamic Studies to always begin a little bit with the author. So could you tell us a little bit about your background in terms of how you got interested in the study of Muslim societies, perhaps mentors or scholars that have been particularly influential in either the types of questions you ask or in the content you deal with? How did you get to where you are?
Yes, thank you. It's always a good thing to reflect on one's intellectual genealogy. I would say that my formative undergraduate education at Bozici University was from 1987 to 1991. And this was a very interesting time for both Turkey and for the region. Turkey was coming out of military coup. We were reading a lot about horrible torture under military regime. There was, in my college, there was a sense of questioning issues of democracy and Turkey's experience in the 20th century and future. But that also, in my college, at least, I was in political science, but took courses with sociology, also coincided with the European debates on modernity. So we read a lot of Habermas we became familiar with Heidegger and Foucault. But what was happening, I think, is that in the late 1980s, the debate was about the meaning of the 20th century, the question of European modernity, its colonialism, its dark past, and how to revive the European Western modern project. And since Turkey's existence also relied on this project of Westernization, I was getting that literature through a very good set of professors at Boğaziçi. I think we have some of the best mentors. But while this is happening, this was also the post-Iranian revolution period in the Middle East. This is Iran-Iraq war was about to end. So we every night on the television we have seen different issues ranging from Salman Rushdie fatwa to the crisis in general of the Middle East. So as a student, I was also linking that issue of debate on Turkish modernity and European Eurocentricism with the crisis of the international order. I think that that was at least in my mind connected with each other. And when I was finishing my last year, Saddam's invasion of Kuwait happened. That international intervention was led to this big debate: and what is the post Cold War order? I mean, this was still the last 5-6 years of the Cold War, and followed by I think Bosnian genocide was a big event because we had a lot of Bosnians in our school, in our neighborhood. I also had very good friends from Kurdish friends from Iraq, Arab from friends from Iraq. So we could follow all of these developments, but then have to link them with issues of Eurocentricism, Islam, new question of Islamism, and this imperfect, messed up world order. And that led me to, when I finished, led me to find this fellowship and go to Malaysia for an MA in Islamic Studies, which was amazing for me because I then realized that I live in Istanbul in a very Europe-oriented world, and Asia didn't exist in my mind. And I still remember the shock of landing in Kuala Lumpur and seeing, you know, a different type of Muslim society, despite all of claims about Muslim politics and identity. It was very unfamiliar work for me. So that's some sort of, I think, the beginning of my intellectual curiosities and interests started with these experiences of 1987 to 1992. Should I continue with MA or PhD, or should we? Yeah, maybe I continue with the MA or PhD. You told me that I could speak
yes,
all the way to 5 minutes. I don't need to have copious conversation nods or interruptions. Well, if I just complete all the way to the end of PhD, I think when I came back from Malaysia from the Islamic Studies course, with these theoretical interests, I wanted to go back to the 19th century Ottoman Muslim intellectual history for my MA work, and inspired by the new post-colonial literature on modernity in Europe, find out how the Ottoman intellectuals responded to the challenge of the West. This is what I was thinking. I was trying to find like the early writings on modernity in the West, and I was hoping to find something very, very critical. So I worked on the journals, Ottoman journals of 1850s and 60s, 1840s to 70s. And to my surprise, I didn't find, at least among the Ottoman elite, or in the journals of Istanbul, I didn't find that much critical writing. And in fact, there was even not a notion of Eastern Islamic civilization in 1840s, 50s. But I could actually, I could trace it. The notion of an Islamic civilization emerging in 1880s, but not earlier, in 1850s, 60s. In the journals that I worked on, nobody even used the word Islam Medeniyet or Hadaratul Islamiyah. I think Ottoman Tanzimat project was relying on this notion of a universal civilization where, as a cosmopolitan empire, they are part of that European project, but just, you know, at a lower level than perhaps Britain and France. So that actually surprised me, and I wanted to do further research, but I also didn't want to be stuck in this exceptionalism of Muslims and Europeans. I wanted to study a non-European society, India, China, or Japan, their experience, and I'm a Hindu, Chinese, and Japanese. So I ended up picking Japan for various reasons, and with that project, I started my PhD work at Harvard to do comparative work of thinking about modernity and Europe in the Ottoman Empire and Japan. But after my coursework, I ended up instead of directly working on modernity, I worked indirectly on Pan-Islamism and Pan-Asianism. So that led to my first book after my PhD. on politics of anti-Westernism in Asia. This is kind of a study of Ottoman and Japanese reflections on the international order and modernity. So while I was doing that book project, September 11 happened. It was in the last year of my PhD it happened, and I actually had the postdoc fellowship by Harvard Academy that was at that time chaired by Sam Huntington. So the person who I criticized in my work had an office just across mine at the office, and he was too busy, but technically was our boss or chairman as a group of postdoctoral fellows. So in my first book, I was actually trying to challenge this notion of Muslim exceptionalism, anti-Muslim, anti-Westernism, showing that Japan also had, China had that kind of similar experience, and it's not about Islam, but it's about the particular late 19th or the 20th century crisis of international order. So the book, in a way, read broadly in that context, just to see, you know, two non-European empires dealing with issues of white supremacy and Christianity and unequal relationship and international law. So when I finished that book, if you want to do final a couple of sentences, my initial impulse, my initial desire was to actually follow after 1945. So my book ends in early book of 45. And to see what happened to pan-Islamism, pan-Asianism, pan-Africanism, these three globalist projects of world order and modernity, and bring it all the way to today. Then I realized among all these three siblings, the three non-European internationalisms, pan-Islamism seemed to have a life different than pan-Asianism and pan-Africanism. That it seems like it came back after Cold War for various reasons. And that inspired this current book to just to look at why pan-Islamism has a revival at the end of the Cold War, and which has something to do with the particular way Muslims were racialized by race, and a particular way the Cold War politics, especially in the Saudi-American alliance, revived an Ottoman-era pan-Islamic internationalism. Yeah. I'll stop here.
No, that's great. And, you know, as somebody who's been a fan of your work for a while, I can see certainly how this book on this concept of the Muslim world emerged out of your earlier projects. And I think it certainly informs this one because you really go to great lengths to give us a very global perspective on this idea. So maybe you could begin in terms of diving into this project in terms of, I guess, what is the kind of the key argument you're trying to make with the book for people that are they're coming to the project?
Thank you. This actually, let me start with one surprising thing for me is that coming from Turkey and from partly from Islamic studies and international relations theory to America, and always working on the issues of the Ottoman Empire and the Middle East and the West, which inevitably takes you to the question of Islam and Christianity and Islam and the West, these big constructs. I wasn't well-read and thinking too much about race theory and question of race and what race meant within empires. And I think over time, I think while finishing my work and comparing Muslim experiences to the experience of the people of the yellow race of China, Japan, or African, black-skinned African experiences, I realized that actually the Muslimness was highly racialized. And now we see that in America very clearly. But, you know, going back to 20, 30, 40 years ago, I guess this, because of the power of Orientalism and Muslim modernism, that we were not clearly discussing this, what it means that Muslimness was racialized in the imperial time, and what is its implications. And I think with that idea in mind, I also benefited a lot from this interdisciplinary conversations I had with a very good group of religious studies scholars who are doing groundbreaking work on Muslim traditions and in Islamic studies. That's your group, I assume. And we, at UNC Chapel Hill, we are lucky to have a very good religious studies program and Islamic studies program. And so the literature on religious studies on race, issue of racialization of Muslim international affairs, and then my previous background on the question of civilization, civilizational narratives, all came together in this book to tie all of these different projects, discursive projects, and they're all tied to the notion of the Muslim world, and to truly try to decolonize our thinking about them, because it all of these issues of being Muslim, definition of Islam as a religious tradition, and Islamic civilization, they're all formed in a particular way, aligned in a particular way with the question of empire and Muslim dignity in late 19th century. And I wanted to focus more on that period and then write a story of this concept that emerged at that time but still lives after 100 years, the idea of the Muslim world. I guess that's maybe I've responded to this question methodologically, but I should just also note, as a historian, of course, we are very disturbed by this grand narratives of Islam and the West, and all of us are very disturbed of it. And it seems like hundreds of our colleagues are, especially in America, in Europe, and other places, are rescuing history from nationalism, different forms of nationalism, rescuing history from Orientalism and the legacies of European power relations, the imperial power relations. And in that project of rescuing, we are all very dissatisfied with the fact that almost 35 years after Edward Said's book, 30 years, there is still, Orientalism is still very powerful. I mean, we assume that, you know, we wrote that book in 78. Most of our scholars are actually, our colleagues are followers of Edward Said, or they share the same sentiments with Edward Said. We produce very complex knowledge in universities. But in media, in the general public, and among the politicians, this binary narratives of Muslims versus the West, the Muslim exceptionalism is very powerful. And I wanted to kind of write a story that will also intervene in this problem that we are dealing with.
Yeah, I think you succeed very comprehensively in that. So you're trying to contest this kind of conflation of the Muslim world as a geopolitical and civilizational and religious entity or group, and you kind of start laying some of the groundwork by demonstrating that in kind of the pre-modern period, empire was usually the basis for conflict. And then there's a shift in the 19th century to where religious communities start to play a key role for the basis of conflict. And you note two kind of shifts. One, the search or the struggle for Christian nationalistic liberation in places like Greece and Serbia and Romania and others. And paired with the colonization of Muslims in South Asia and Central Asia and North Africa by French and Russian and British imperialists. So this I think is a real key moment here. And so can you help us figure this out? What are the effects of these two processes happening kind of simultaneously?
No, thank you, Deb. I think this is one of the most important issues that we need more work to overcome amnesia. So we are assuming that Muslims always lived as a as a unity. So there was a Muslim unity. Muslims were always together, and they ruled over non-Muslims as if empires didn't matter. There's always this zero-sum game. You either Muslims rule over non-Muslims, and non-Muslims rule over Muslims. And there's always this clash between imagined Muslim political community in relation to the Christian West or the Hindus or other non-Muslim entities. What I was trying to show that, especially after the Mongolian experience in Eurasia, Muslims lived in one or a different form of empire, and most of these empires could not be reduced to the religious markers, so that they are not Islamic or theological empires, even though they are ruled by Muslim dynasties or monarchs. But these Muslim dynasties or monarchs are not acting out a textual project of implementing an Islamic political system. That actually their experiences are always more complex and they're proud Muslims. They have respect for Muslim values and they practice those. But there are also many more. So many of them had respect for Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan, and they don't see the diversity as a threat to them. So they actually cherish and embrace this diversity. And the Muslims actually lived in close proximity with Armenians and Greeks in Anatolia. But actually more Muslims lived next to non-Christians, so Hindus and Buddhists. We also don't want to think about Muslim history only in relation to the Christian Europe. There are more Muslims who live in Asia. There are actually more Muslims have an experience of coexistence with Hindus and Buddhists, their encounters with them. And that was the normal thing in history, that you don't have a nationalist project, that the history of the world is actually the history of empires until the late 19th century. And when European empires come in different forms, there is no immediate response in the form of pan-Islamism or Muslim solidarity. In fact, the age of European empires only in the kind of mid-19th century were seen by these different Muslim dynasties as an opportunity to also self-strengthen and empower themselves. And we forget about the experience of the kind of Egyptian, autonomous Egyptian dynasty under the Ottoman rule, but the old Ottoman Tanzimat project. There are, the Persian kingdom, there are so many other Muslim political entities in Africa and other places. And in the initial encounter with European empires, until the sharp racialization in the late 19th century, there is resistance sometimes, there is dissatisfaction, people have different projects, but there is not an automatic assumption of anti-imperialism. That many Muslims could live with a different form of within an empire, and they could ask for their rights and empowerment within an imperial context. So I took people like Sayyid Ahmed Khan more seriously. There are so many like him. But in that context, the story, I think that this what is new about this project is that to show the connections with this accident of history, that one of the big empires ruled by a Muslim dynasty, the Ottomans, ruling over large Christian populations in the Balkans, and believing in this kind of civilizing mission, self-civilizing mission of empowering the empire through Tanzimat reforms, have this experience of Christian majority areas from Greece, Serbia, Bulgaria, trying to be independent or to secede. It's also not truly nationalist because they all had their own kings, right? That is, it's not a republic project. Even Greece actually adopts a German king. And I was very surprised to see how their experience, their story gets connected to also the story of Indian Muslims, particularly. From 1870s onwards, the notion that the world is a world of empowered empires. And if and the Ottoman the Indian Muslims are proud of the Ottoman Empire, not because this empire is oppressing the Christians, but because actually they see this empire doing a better job than the British in terms of allowing Armenians and Greeks to have higher level positions as ambassadors and ministers. just they're interested in the Ottoman Empire and later on as a caliphate in this, partly in this geopolitical context of Ottoman-British alliance, but also partly as a way to tell the British is that, look, you claim to be more civilized, but there are no Hindus and Muslims in the higher administration. Look at this other empire, the Ottomans, who is ruled by a Muslim dynasty, but it has it has all these non-Muslim ministers and bureaucrats. That means that it's more inclusive, more respectless, a better empire. But that connection also creates this pattern where empires are challenged by the logic of population politics, meaning that the Greeks claim that Christian Greeks should rule over Greece, and that there's a separation of Greece from the Ottoman Empire. And we forget that there were Muslims in Greece, right? And nobody remembers. Now there are, again, as immigrants, but there are also Muslims in Greece, Ottoman Muslims, who were expelled from this land. So there's this struggle to keep a cosmopolitan empire against the notion of a kind of proto-nationalistic notion of a territory matching with a religion and an ethnicity. So I kind of trace that logic and show the kind of racialization of Muslimness entangled with the Ottoman story and the Indian story and also the story of other European empires.
That's maybe a good place to go because you've talked about this idea of racialization, but in the book you do a very good job of kind of delineating that process and both kind of what are the underpinning social logics for racializing Muslims, but also the social consequences. So could you help us think about how Muslims were being conceptualized in these imperial contexts?
I think this is maybe in order – this is a very important part of the story. But just to imagine a counterfactual case where European empires going around Africa and Asia, racializing some people as black-skinned, some yellow-skinned in Asia. And in between the yellow-skinned and black-skinned people, there's a large group of Hindus and Muslims. And they could have just called them brown. Like in America, for example, there a lot of Islamophobic violence is also directed against Hindus and Sikhs because they're brown skin, right? So the American right wing or the racists have this notion that the Muslims are brown skinned. And in fact, in 1860s and 70s, there are actually some references of calling the people between China and Africa as brown skin, which would actually made racialization of Hindus and Muslims together. But instead, for various reasons, that Muslims were racialized through their religion, similar to Jews. And we have to understand that it's the British or the French coming through Africa, seeing Muslims in different parts of Africa, marking them as Muslim first, and then coming to India again Muslim. And it's a large geography. And then in the Middle East, and the Ottomans and the Arabs are also marked as Muslim. They have very different experiences, but I think this racialization in the late 19th century became more rigid. It gained theoretical justifications. Ernest Renan called Muslims as a Semitic religion, so it's like Semitic religion. And there, it also gained legal discriminatory character. So if you are a Muslim in the French Empire, technically you could be a citizen, but if you're a Muslim, you can't be a full citizen. Right? That right is not given to you. So the French just racializes all of its Muslim subjects. Despite his claim for Republican universality, by saying that if you're following Sharia, you can't be fully citizen, you're just one level below whites. And that, of course, that logic led to this whole Algerian separation that at the end, of course, at the independence of Algeria, all the white settlers, together with Jews, have to just felt uncomfortable and went back to France, while French citizen Muslims were immediately classified as Algerian and then had to be in Algeria. So the racialization had this kind of legal logic behind it. And in India, or in the 40% of the Muslim societies ruled by the British Empire, or in the Dutch Empire, being Muslim had kind of legal discriminatory aspects, or legal classification aspects. And a similar story was in the Russian Empire. So that all of these trans-imperial zones had racialized Muslims with reference to the notions of Christianity's superiority to Islam, or white races, Anglo-Saxon superiority over the colored races. So I think that this late 19th century moment of an imperial world produced a racialized Muslim world within it. And then the book kind of talks in detail about how this process happened and how people began to refer to the idea of the Muslim world only in the late 19th century.
Yeah. The other component to this from another side is Muslim modernists are also kind of creating or producing or articulating an essentialized Islam in many ways, very similar to imperial practices. So can you talk about some of the themes and how they're what are some of the thematic domains that Muslim authors were constructing the Muslim world narrative in? How did they articulate the identity?
Yeah, that's an important turning point. So the Muslimness is not just ascribed, it's also embraced and internally worked out and redefined. So the ascribed Muslimness argues that by 1880, 80% of the Muslims were ruled by European empires, so the other 20% were the Ottomans. And that geopolitical story is very interesting because the Ottoman Empire, ruling over Mecca, Medina, Jerusalem, had this kind of prime real estate, and a sultan with a long lineage who also claimed to be caliph. So the part of the story that I am telling before I got to the Muslim modernism is that the Ottoman sultan, the Ottoman government, in order to get back to this period of Ottoman-British alliance against Russia, played with the idea that the Britain rules over this large Muslim populations in India. So Queen Victoria is the greatest Muslim monarch, while the Ottomans are the spiritual caliph. So these two great powers, great Muslim powers, should be in alliance. And that comes out of Ottoman weakness. And many people refer to that idea from Winston Churchill to Sultan Abdulhamid's Muslim representative in England named Abdullah William Killiam. So that geopolitics actually is completely forgotten now because both sides don't want to remember this moment, because we look back to this period from the point of 1914 Ottoman Jihad. So if there is one geopolitical pan-Islamism, it's basically an Ottoman-British alliance project which turned anti-British in 1914. And the book tells this story that something similar happens with this Saudi-American alliance in 1970s against Nasser, basically a new pan-Islamic project to defeat Nasser and the Soviet Union, which turned anti-American after Camp David. But under it, I think the more interesting project for the scholars of Islamic studies is that the late 19th century is also the period where Muslim reformists are redefining the Islamic world in a new way to overcome their racialization. So racialization by religion gives Muslim scholars an opportunity to refute racial inferiority by showing that Islam belongs to this great civilization. It has all these intellectual resources, and it can counter accusation of inferiority both by missionaries and Orientalists. So that's why the Muslim Modernism Project is critical, but also very constructive. It's a hermeneutic project to redefine Islam, partly in a textual way, saying that the Muslims seem to be declined and colonized, but the real Islam is different. If Muslim, in a kind of Darwinist Spencerian way, if Muslims are awakened to the sources of their religion, glory of their past, then they can be awakened and they gain their rights either within the empire, to gain equality within empire, not necessarily anti-imperialist, but also, in 20s and 30s, they also thought that the Muslim civilization and the Muslim equality deserve them to have their own nations and independence. So this Muslim modernist project, in a way, reified and embraced the idea of the Muslim world, for various political projects. So one could be that if you're too small, too weak, you can easily be defeated. But if you imagine a global solidarity, you can do collective bargaining. They actually use this word collective bargaining in different points. That if you're a Muslim in Egypt or India or Turkey alone, you can't defeat this alliance of great European racist empires. But if you imagine a Muslim world between China and Europe, then you're more powerful. There's some sort of politics of numbers. And as Faisal did, you talked about that, actually politics of numbers also diminish the fears of Muslims of being a minority in a kind of future free India in comparison to Hindu majority. But beyond that, I think that this notion of creating an Islamic civilization was also worked out by Muslim modernists, saying that if Europe had this miraculous story of Greece, Roman Empire, then science and Renaissance and reform, Muslims also had their own miraculous story. So the early Islam looks like Greeks, and there's an emphasis on Andalus. There's an emphasis on the Golden Age, and the story of Golden Age and decline is there. So Islam is defined as a civilization. Muslim world is defined as a civilization, and in that process, Istanbul is linked to Senegal, that linked to Java. So you imagine all these Muslims are in an interconnected civilization. While this is happening, I mean, as Niall Green and many other colleagues mentioned, that there's a Sima Alevi wrote a book on this as well, that there's this sort of imperial grid that strengthened Muslim connectivity through steamships, telegraphs, and printing. And that's not the intention of the empires. And so, ironically, the imperial age united the Muslims, not only politically. I mean, half of the Muslims' first time in history actually was united under British Empire, but also in terms of their mobility, the speed of their travel, their connectivity increase. So more Muslims began to come to Hajj. The numbers to Hajj increased almost 10 times. Journal subscriptions were actually giving people a sense of pride. So Rashid Rida could publish Al-Manar and send it all over Russian Empire, British Empire, French Empire. And he actually is aware that this journal in Cairo under this Ottoman British rule, right? Egypt was still under Ottoman rule, and Rashid Rida was actually from Syria, so from the Ottoman lands. But he's realizing that the Islamic world is bigger than the Ottoman Empire, or even bigger than the British Empire. I mean, so his journal actually reaches to Delhi, Bombay, or Calcutta, and even to Japan or Southeast Asia. So all of these are not all words. There's also a kind of a felt experience of being better connected as Muslims from all over the world. But racialization gives Muslims a reason to talk back, to create a narrative of history. And in that narrative of history, in addition to civilization, they also emphasize kind of a historic conflict between imperial West and the victimized Muslim world. So there's suddenly crusaders are linked to modern colonialism. And that link wasn't always there in their mind. One other aspect that I emphasize that is highly overlooked is the fact that early pan-Islamists are very cosmopolitan and globalist in terms of their alliances with theosophists, their sympathies with Japan and China or Indian Hindu Indians, or their interest in African other non-Muslim Africans. So there is some sort of sense of internationalism beyond the Muslims, and that we shouldn't forget about that aspect, of course. But what does happen overall, of course, is that the generation of Sayyid Emir Ali, who wrote the book The Spirit of Islam, basically redefines what it means to be Muslim, how to talk about Islam as a universal religious tradition and as a civilization. Because I 100 years before Sayyid Emir Ali, no Muslim would write a book called The Spirit of Islam. That's actually quite a confidence, right? That you have the, you know what the spirit of Islam is. But he has to write it because he's actually responding to accusations of Christian missionaries and Orientalists.
Now, there's a great deal of detail that's going through the book here that we probably won't be able to get to. But you proceed into the kind of post-Ottoman early 20th century, where new shifting political entities and networks of power, different types of propagandist writing are happening. Can you tell us a little bit how the Muslim world narrative began to be operationalized in the early 20th century?
So this takes the second half of the book. What happens to the idea of the Muslim world after World War I? So the book's main narratives argue that Sultan Abdulhamid II, even though he's associated with this kind of anti-Western pan-Islamism, was actually not anti-imperial or anti-Western. He was actually trying to use this new notion of the Muslim world to empower Ottoman geopolitical significance in the eyes of the British, but others, but also to imagine an imperial world in which Muslims form some sort of a peaceful glue. Because we forget that the generation of Abdulhamid could not imagine that the imperial world will end. We ought to always look back at history from the perspective of nationalism, but Abdulhamid's generation still, even in 1913, just before World War One, you wouldn't believe that all of these empires are going to disappear. So there's a question of racial equality, and equality of the Ottomans in international law, but that you could always solve them within the imperial framework. So what changes is actually this accident of World War One, which preceded by gradual Ottoman-British tensions, but these tensions necessarily not leading to World War One. So if you take the World War One, starting with the Italians invading Libya, which leads to this big pan-Islamic campaign, then the Balkan Wars. The Serbian foreign minister says that they actually get encouraged by no European power in stopping Italians invading Libya, Ottoman Libya. They then decided that, well, maybe they should just attack the Ottomans as well. So there's actually a connection between these two events. An Ottoman defeat in the Balkan Wars, pushing all these Muslims away. So the kind of Balkan area becomes only Christians and the Muslims have to go to the Ottoman lands. At that point, we see a peak in pan-Islamic mobilization, where Indian Muslims instrumentalize this idea that the British Empire has a moral responsibility to intervene and help Turkey, both in Italian against Italians and also in the Balkan Wars. The reason is that the British Empire is the biggest Muslim empire in the world. So this is completely forgotten, the status of the British Empire as the biggest Muslim empire. But because of racism, of course, Britain does not intervene, partly because of racism. They say, well, yes, we are the biggest Muslim empire, but we have to stay neutral and there isn't much I can do. So that's when Germans are seeing this, there's a different instrumentalization appears in the minds of Kaiser Wilhelm. Surprised that Ottoman Empire can be so powerful at the time of their defeat. They are defeated in the Balkan Wars, but they are ever more popular in India. And so when the war starts and these Germans find themselves against the British, Germans want Ottomans on their side because they think that they're also racist and Orientalist in some ways. They think that the Muslims will never accept a Christian ruler. If they take the Ottomans on their side and use Ottoman Caliph's credentials as a leader of the Muslim world, then they can provoke Muslims to a revolt against their rival empires. So they have this idea, and some of the young Turks have that idea too. So it's actually not the traditional Sultan Abdulhamid, but it's the young Turks who instrumentalize the idea of the Muslim world and the Ottoman Empire status as the kind of spiritual head of the Muslim world to rebel against the British. And in some ways, they're basically pragmatically utilizing this idea, even though 6 months before the 1914 jihad, Ottoman diplomats were still offering Britain a project of alliance, saying that if you ally with me, then my caliph will tell Indian Muslims to be even more loyal to you. But what I told in the chapter on World War I is that despite the Ottoman jihad proclamation, British, French, Russian Muslims remain loyal to their empires. In fact, there is this counter-proclamations, and the Ottomans realized that you can't really ask Muslims to revolt. But what changes everything is not the beginning of the war, but the end of the war. The Balfour Declaration, Sykes-Picot, and the Britain, perceived sense of Britain betraying its promise to Muslims who fought and died for them. Because in 1914, the Muslim soldiers or the Muslim elites in India who fought for Britain, even against Ottomans, argued that we fight for you, but you have to keep your promise that don't interfere in holy lands, do not touch the caliph, that the caliphate has to remain. There's a similar sense of a social contract whether for the French Muslims and the Russian ones, although Russian story changes dramatically after Bolshevik Revolution. So I put more emphasis on the end of the war, not the beginning. That's why I said at the moment of Woodrow Wilson and Lenin, the biggest social movement, social mobilization in 1920, 21, 22, is the pan-Islamic Khilafat movement, which is a kind of a return to this non-jihadist Abdulhamid era of Turkey and Ottoman Empire utilizing Indian Muslims for peaceful purposes, pressuring London, sending them military and financial aid, or financial aid or medical aid. And I think without that Indian Muslim mobilization, Turkey would not have negotiated the foundational treaty of Lausanne in 1922 or 23 with the British Empire. I think Britain, in addition to having military problems against the Turkish War of Independence, were really worried about even Hindus and Sikhs joining Muslims in India in support of the Turkish War of Independence. So you can see that instrumentalization worked very well and for Turkey's political interest. Although it starts with jihad, but it turns peaceful. But it is important. I think this is the peak moment of pan-Islamism, which is followed by this big disaster and a disappointment where Turkey abolishes the caliphate in March 2nd, 1924.
And you explore this moment of the abolishment of the caliphate and also look at kind of this interwar period where there are several key theorists thinking about what an Islamic state should look like, what are the kind of underlying principles of that kind of political entity, and as well as where Muslim populations fit into kind of networks of power during World War II. Just to keep the listeners up to speed here, you're going to have to read the book if you want to hear find out more about that. And if you don't mind, Jamil, I want to kind of jump to the post-Second World War period where popular secular nationalism is becoming widespread, and we have Muslim world narrative fitting into decolonization efforts and emerging national settings. Can you talk about where the Muslim world narrative fits in here? How is it relative again?
No, so thank you. Post-war is a crucial turning point where, in some way, Muslim world narrative was about to disappear. It looked like to disappear. And I mentioned this conference at Duke University in early 1960s where people discuss, this scholars of Islam and Orientalists and IR theorists, what is the role of Islam in international affairs? And they conclude that none. They actually make fun of Bernard Lewis at the time. Bernard Lewis was still racist, apparently, and said that Islam is like communism. They have this fanatic allegiance, and they will never be. They will always be anti-Western. But they quote him to make fun of him, saying that, you know, that there are crazy people like that. But when we look at facts on the ground, there is no explanatory value to Islam. I mean, look at Nasser, Iraq, Pakistan's foreign policy. All these post-colonial Muslim nations are different goals and different objectives, and nobody is calling for a caliphate. Nobody is calling for some sort of Islamic state. This is kind of a low point. So I have this puzzle, is that how did it then come back? You know, why was this nostalgia for the caliphate even stronger in the 80s and 90s? And there I kind of work on the story of regional Cold War plus the global Cold War, where against the Nasser's alliance with the Soviet Union and Nasser's challenge to Saudi Arabia, the Saudi King Faisal becomes like the caliph of the Cold War, in a way trying to revive older networks of pan-Islamism with Medina University, with the Muslim World Council, bringing Indian Muslims who are disillusioned by the project of Pakistan, such as Mehdudi, to help bolster Saudi Arabia's soft power and image, and try to form an internationalism relying on older templates of the Muslim world in order to strengthen Saudi Arabia's international position with regard to Nasser. I think he felt threatened by Nasser. But only after 67, of course, he's also thinking that this kind of pan-Islamic internationalism in alliance with third worldism would also help empower the Palestinians in the sole Palestine question. So there's before 67 against Nasser, but after 67 is actually in cooperation with Egypt in order to help Palestine and solve some of the regional questions. So this story then becomes very interesting, where I was very surprised to find it out, where Enver Sadat became almost like Ataturk or the Young Turks in 1975, 76. After 73, I didn't realize 74, Enver Sadat had a great reputation. He's a dark-skinned Egyptian leader. He fought this war that nobody thought Egypt will fight. So there's this amazing summit in 1974, Lahore summit, where Pakistan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, their leaders apparently appear saying that, look, we create this new Muslim bloc, that Egypt has the population and the army. Well, Egypt has the army, Pakistan has the population, and now the new Arab oil money come together to form an international pressure group to help Palestinians and other oppressed Muslims. So there's this kind of subaltern Muslim interest in this project. So Camp David, I was very surprised to see how Camp David changed a lot, because I think people expected that this pressure will produce something for the Palestinians, where in some ways Camp David became something like Lausanne Treaty with Turkey did, right? That Turkey benefited from the pan-Islamic public opinion and mobilization to get a very good deal for the Turkish Republic. But then it seems like it betrayed the Muslim world that it benefited from, imaginary Muslim world and its mobilization. And Egypt seemed to be doing something similar with the Camp David, that I think Sadat's negotiating power also comes from this great excitement about new geopolitical and economic realignment among Arab and Muslim countries. And after Camp David, there's this chaos. We're like, what happened? We thought that this regional unity will produce something good. And it's in that context, of course, a couple of unexpected turning points happens, like the Iranian Revolution, Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which leads to even further weakening of alternative secular internationalism, like Pan-Africanism, socialist internationalism, third worldism, and many more Muslims began to believe that a new internationalism should rely on the mobilization of power and geopolitical unity of the Muslim world. And that's the 1980s story. And that makes my book very pessimistic in a way, that once that happens and this, you know, pulled from hostage crisis to Salman Rushdie affair, this appeal to Muslim solidarity revived all kind of racial tropes in Europe and America. And that's why I think the the second book Edward Said wrote on Orientalism, Covering Islam, is partly also showing his dissatisfaction, surprise that Islamophobia and Orientalism became worse compared to 1978. Edward Said's book was published just before the Iranian Revolution, and post-Iranian Revolution, post-hostage crisis, racism against Arabs and Muslims increased. So we enter in a period where there's a symbiotic relationship between pan-Islamists appealing to Muslim unity and this kind of complex politics in the region re-racialization of Muslims in European and American media. I think we might still be living the kind of continuation of that period of 1980s today.
Yeah. And you kind of make a nod at the end of the book to the fact that both Islamophobes and groups like ISIS share a very similar Muslim world narrative. So maybe as kind of a final thought, can you tell us what should we make of a Muslim world narrative in our current moment, and how might your historical genealogy help us understand it today?
As a historian, everything, my book, of course, is trying to tell Muslims and non-Muslims to reflect on the amnesia that they have, to reflect on the different turning points. That's the project about genealogy, to actually understand where certain ideas and concepts come from, how they change over time, so that it can be fictionalized, it can be undone, and we can see the lost features of different moments and different trajectories. So, let's say, even if there is some sort of a seeming similarity between first racialization of Muslims in the Age of Empires in the 1880s and the re-racialization of Muslims in the 1980s, or the first pan-Islamism of Abdulhamid and the second or the third pan-Islamism of King Faisal and Khomeini, the differences are actually very important. One is that in the earlier imperial one, the assumption is very cosmopolitan. Abdulhamid did not try to impose Sharia on non-Muslims, or he was a cosmopolitan figure whose primary job was to keep a cosmopolitan empire alive. He had very proud non-Muslim servants and bureaucrats, and he couldn't have imagined, for example, despite his reputation as a man who did the Armenian massacres of 1890s, but he wouldn't have imagined the ethnic cleansing of Armenians from Anatolia or Greek-Turkish population exchange. I think these were unimaginable for him even as late as 1880s. So we see this multiple partitions and the end of the cosmopolitan imperial legacy within those 100 years, where Turks and Greeks and Armenians are sorted out. Of course, the Arabs and Jews are sorted out in some ways in the Israel-Palestine story. But more importantly, the largest group of Muslims in South Asia with nationalism, the partition of Pakistan, India, also separated people out. So there's this one move away from inclusive imperial structures to ethnic nationalism. The second big move, of course, is the significance of South Asian Muslims being replaced by Arab and then later on Persian Muslims. So the center of people talking about Islam moves to the Arab lands and to Iran as well. Initially, it was just the Ottomans and the Indian Muslims, and then now it's a bit different actors are out there. But within those stories, I think what is usually forgotten is that there is a lot of Cold War ideological project invested in pan-Islamism of the new one, right? That Islamism becomes an ideology. It's a vision of a complete system of reordering a nation state, telling citizens what to do. That, I think, early pan-Islamism never had that kind of a thing. And I kind of refer to the fact that Ottoman caliphs listened to opera music and they were interested in painting. And the last Ottoman caliph's hobby was painting his daughter's portraits. This could have been unthinkable, right, for a caliph today. Whoever claims to be caliphate, they have no concept of these practices. So with that, I want to show the historicity of what it of Muslim politics to liberate some of the good actors. And I talk less about good actors. I feel bad about it. You know, the subaltern Muslims who are oppressed, who search for their rights. It seems they invest on medium Muslim powers and the kings, like the Ottomans and Egyptians and Saudis and Pakistanis, but feel betrayed by them, right? The states have to prioritize the interests of a state over the interest of oppressed Muslim populations. So by doing that, I also want to empower those people who want to still be proud of their Muslim values in terms of politics. I don't mean to tell that nobody should have any politics based on their religious values. So in my story, but I also talk about how a particular form of imaginary Muslim world politics was so instrumentalized by state actors and imperial actors that it always led to more and more divisions and disillusionment. And it actually produced the opposite of what it's supposed to do, some sort of creating Muslim political unity, that the Muslims are actually more divided politically than ever, because I think the project itself is unrealistic, that, you know, we can't assume that the Muslims are not differentiated by any kind of sense of class, gender, or political desires. And last word, probably, to see that the symbiotic relationship that some of the pan-Islamic project had with the racialization of Muslims through religion and geopolitics, and to break that symbiotic tie so that to help fight against racialization in a better way, also to kind of imagine a different, more emancipatory, more free form of Muslim politics beyond the existing frameworks that is suffocating many forms of imagination.
Well, Jamil, you've done a wonderful job with the book, and I do hope that listeners will pick it up, and I wish you the best success with the book. I was very excited also as a sinologist to see China included there on several occasions. Thank you for that.
Yes. And Japan too, right?
And Japan too, of course, right? There's few of us working in East Asia thinking about Muslims, but I'm glad you're doing that. Where do you see your research going now? What kind of things are you working on today? What might we see from you in the near future?
So two projects: one in 1971, 70s, 1880s, and 90s. I want to focus globally more on the transition from 1970s to 1980s. A lot is happening, and the last decade of the Cold War prepared the background for the crisis of the international order we are dealing with today. So I want to look at that carefully. I cooperate with my colleague Timothy Noonan, who wrote a book on humanitarian invasion. He's also working on similar topics that I work on. He's working on the kind of divergence between Sunni and Shia Muslim internationalism. I also work on kind of the details of this critical left Muslim, the transition from the critical left Muslim political visions to a more conservative ones in the 1980s and 1990s. This is one project. The other one is back on the 19th century. I want to more on in details on the end of the cosmopolitan empires, the struggles over international law. So there are some smaller projects on Ottoman Empire and international law and how they, in what way they try to turn the caliphate into an international legal project, if they could ever do it. There's more interest on this topic. So we have my colleague here at Duke who published a book on the end of the caliphate, Mona Hassan. Maybe that would be of interest for you as well. But I was asked to think about whether caliphate was ever turned into a project of international law, sort of international legal concept. And I want to answer that question by working in detail of that issue. So there are other global history projects as well that I'm working on. So I'm also doing some service to the field, and I will co-edit this series on global history at Columbia Press. So I'm reading really interesting manuscripts by my colleagues.
Well, Jamil, good luck on all of those projects, and thank you for your continued efforts in making us expand our the domains where we try to think about these questions related to Islamic studies. This is a great book.
Thank you, Christian, and hope to talk to you about on more on East Asia and Muslim societies.
That was my conversation with Jamil Aydin about his great new book, The Idea of the Muslim World, A Global Intellectual History, published with Harvard University Press in 2017. Thanks for joining us again on New Books in Islamic Studies.